This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer podcast, as we take a deep dive into some of our favourite parts over the last few weeks. It is your chance to listen back to some amazing experts, hear the questions that your fellow Dubai Eye listeners had to ask, and of course, hear some real life stories too. We were overwhelmed recently when we spoke to Hanan Ezzedine from the Family Hub about positive discipline and how to raise confident kids. It seems an awful lot of us are struggling right now, whether that is big feelings and small bodies or our kids just feeling a little bit overwhelmed. What did she have to say? She was taking your questions as well. And we've all been reporting some strange side effects of the pandemic in ways like brain fog, concentration levels, bizarre dreams. We were in conversation with Samra Arish of The Brain and Learning, offering up some tips on how to boost our brain power, and she was busting a few myths as well. And looking ahead to the next couple of months, we know that exam cancellations are rife and the impact it's having on our teens and our families as well. So what did Jamie Kilcaldy of Oxford AQA have to say about that decision, about the alternative that is being offered up and the stress and strains it might put on teachers? And going back from teens to tiny ones, did you play music to your baby when it was in the womb? What about going to classes? Discussing the impact music can have on positive development in our baby's brains.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is all about children's health, but parenting, about education on a Sunday afternoon and raising confident kids is hard enough as it is. But during the pandemic, it has been incredibly challenging. All those textbook tips are out of the window, schedules turned upside down, self-doubt on the rise and pretty frayed patience and tempers amongst most parents. So I'm joined live now by Hanan Ezzedine, who's the founder of the Family Hub. It's an online platform that helps parents and teachers with positive discipline with children and some really practical advice as well. Hanan, thank you so much for being with us today. Before we get into this tricky topic, which I think it is, to be honest, can you tell us a little bit about what you do at the Family Hub?
Of course. Thank you, Helen, for having me again. And I love being part of your show. What we do is that we offer a lot of content that's rich with information about parenting, about like positive discipline advice, supporting parents through just coaching them and helping them with all of the aspects of like raising their kids. And we offer one-on-one consultations and we offer workshops as well. So, yeah,
now,
this is what we do.
The idea of raising confident kids, there is no handbook for this.
No.
but there are some things that we can do. And that doesn't mean we have to attend a workshop or read endless books.
No.
I tend to buy parenting books for me and my husband and we never read them because it just feels it just doesn't feel realistic to actually sit down at the end of a busy day and absorb it. My attention span, especially over the course of the last year, is just in the toilet. So
Yeah. You
are here today to give us some practical tips that required not buying a book, but just concentrating and listening for a few moments. Can you tell us a little bit about why it's important to raise confident kids? What can ultimately lead to? And then conversely, if you don't?
To be honest, when we all become parents, the one thing that we want is to have our kids be the best version of themselves. And this is what I always tell mine, right? I want to see you as the best version of yourself. And what happens is when our kids are not stimulated, they don't feel like they can achieve something, that they're not capable, and they start convincing themselves with these things, they don't really achieve much. And like all the capabilities that they were born with and all the energy that they have is just gone. And that's why it's really important to make sure that our kids' self-esteem is at its best.
And unfortunately, you know, as I said, patience fraying, tempers a bit problematic amongst a lot of parents. We can, you know, often completely innocently say things that can be really damaging to our kids' confidence and our kids' self-esteem. And, you know, during the pandemic, it has been really hard for kids. You know, they can't make some decisions on their own. They haven't got that, you know, self-advocacy and loads of restrictions regards to where they can go, who they can hang out with, what they can do. And this must chip away at their self-esteem as well. Have you seen that with any families you've been working with?
All the time. And a lot of times, actually, I've seen it with mine. Once when, you know, one of these squabbles with my son, he was 9 years old at the time. And I said, oh my God, I can't believe you lost your jacket again. You're so irresponsible. And I said it apparently a few times without really, you know, noticing that I'm doing that. And then one time I gave him a task to do something at home. And he's like, mommy, no, I can't take responsibility for this because I'm irresponsible. And I said, no, you're not. You're this and that and that. And he's like, no, but you said I was not responsible when I lost my jacket, you know. And like the incident of the jacket got lost. But in his head, the trait of not being responsible just stuck in his head. And it took us a while to get back that skill again, you know. So it's very important that we're mindful of this.
Absolutely. And I think your example is so, so key because, you know, as parents, we haven't really got the time to kind of like flesh out these issues with children and to kind of really take time in that moment to think it through and think about long-term impact. You know, we're just trying to keep our heads above water so much of the time, especially right now, you know, keeping the household in order, trying to keep jobs. And it can feel like we're just getting it wrong at every turn, which is so, so difficult for parents. It really is. I wanted to come to a couple of messages we've had had for you. One from Sammy saying, would really appreciate some advice from your expert. Our 8-year-old is a very happy soul unless she's not doing well at something. It's piano lessons right now. She can't cope when she misses a note, stops immediately and starts crying. Zero resilience, basically. How can we show her that it's okay to get things wrong, and do we need to see an expert? Thank you, Sammy, for that.
Yeah, that's an awesome question. Okay, I think with this, we need to stop focusing on results and start focusing on effort. So instead of saying, oh my God, I love it when the note is perfect or when the song is done, we just say, I love how you continuously play it for 5 minutes on and on, and it shows that you have talent and that you can push yourself and so on. So you focus on qualities that are sustainable rather than the song sounded well and we liked what you've done. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot. Like what you were saying, something, Helen, that was amazing, which is I don't have time to read a parenting book. And I'm already stressed out and so on. This is why platforms like ours and platforms like yours are important, because it makes us mindful that we know that this is what we need to do. We mess up along the way, and this is completely normal, all of us. But we just need to be kind to ourselves and know and reflect and know that when we do a mistake or something, we need to go back and try to fix it or just move on and be kind to ourselves.
It's funny because it is UK Mother's Day today, and when I was getting ready for work, I saw a little piece of paper poking out from under my pillow, and it was a letter from my daughter, who is just turned 6. And you know, we had her parent teacher meeting a couple of weeks ago, and you know, it was great rapport. You know, really proud, really happy. And the teacher did just say, you know, she's very, very conscious of wanting to get everything right. And I've had this with Phoebe when it comes to her writing. You know, she'll really concentrate, and if she spells something wrong or she makes a mistake, you know, leaves out a finger space or, you know, whatever, that's it. I know exactly what Sammy's saying. I see her little face is crumple, and it absolutely breaks my heart. And this letter she wrote this morning, I fully cried because it was just happy Mother's Day. Also, she'd addressed it to Helen. It really made me laugh, like you know, she has another mother who's not called Helen.
Your mommy.
I know, and I was like, to Helen. It felt quite formal. But, you know, she hadn't got all of her spellings right, and I'm sure she knew that, but I was just so proud that she'd said what she wanted to say. She'd said, you know, I love you with all my heart, and she spelled all O-R-L. And I was like, oh, I'm going to keep this forever. But, yeah, I think Sammy's point about, keep on going. Praise the concentration, praise the effort.
If I can add something to this, Helen, just a small thing. I see this with my students every day because I teach seniors and juniors, grade 11 and 12, and they have, they overwhelm themselves when they cannot get something right, if they don't get the A every single time. And you see them, you know, so stressed out, acne breaks in their faces, their hair falls at this very young age because of the stress of, what did I get on my exam and how much did I score? And I'm glad that Sammy asked this question, because we need to keep focusing on effort and effort and effort rather than what did you get at the end of the day in terms of grades.
Thank you, Hanan. Hanan, a message from Zoe here Zoe, I read this, nodding along because you're reading my mind. Zoe's saying, curious for expert input on this. My boys are crazy competitive with each other. They're 4 and 7. Get ready for this. And we'll literally fight over who does the longest wee to who gets the most snacks. I don't know how to diffuse this. It sometimes gets violent. Please help. Zoe, you are not alone.
And definitely not.
My girls are exactly the same. They will fight over who holds which hand of mine. They'll fight over anything. And we know we kind of sometimes use kind of a bit of a competitive spirit to get them to do things like, you know, who can run to the bathroom fastest and who can brush their teeth and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And then it backfires because they will literally fight about anything. So how can you diffuse that? I think that's a really good question, Zoe.
It's a really good question. And you know why they're fighting for it? Because that's how they think that they get their parents' attention.
Mm.
At that age, it's okay, so if I run to the bathroom and I brush my teeth first, or if I finish whatever I have to finish, so I get respect from mom, I get love from dad, and so on, which is completely not true. But in their head, that's how they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we need to do is to stop that, like stop that whole competition thing, even though it does get like quick results, but it backfires.
Mega.
For all of us, right? Okay. Yeah, just backfire. So we need to stop that. We have to avoid comparisons. Like, and we do that like without thinking. Oh, someone's taller than the other one. Someone's smarter than the other one. Sometimes quicker. But we just need to stop comparing the kids to each other, because even if we don't think they hear it, but mm-hmm. they sense what we're saying and they know. And really, really importantly, during a low stress period, if this is something that's recurring, sit them together and create like a family rule guidebook thing, or not doesn't have to be written, but just an unspoken rule of, no, actually a spoken rule of, this is what we do. This is not allowed. It's not allowed that you hit each other. It's not allowed that you bicker. It's not allowed that, and these are the consequences if you do that. And it could be as simple as everybody goes to their room until we all calm down and then we can come back. And it's not easy not to get involved. I will always say don't get involved, but I get involved with mine as well sometimes.
If only.
I just want to say that. But it's true that when we stop getting involved, the issue, it just goes away quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a lot of restraint and it takes a lot of effort. And again, I cannot emphasize the concept of low stress periods. When they're fighting or when they're in the heat of the battle, there's no point in talking to them with like any sense. But when everybody's calm and quiet, that's when we can bring in some house rules.
Okay, I'm trying this, because over the weekend we went camping and I was driving the car off road, and over a bit of a tricky part, and I said to the girls in the back, Mummy, really need you to be quiet so I can concentrate. And one of them started chatting. The other one went, Mummy, I'm being quiet. I'm like, oh! You know, they get competitive about who's the worst one, who's the best one. It is endless. But
yeah.
You're exactly right. When things are a bit more fraught, it's the worst possible time to try and find any reason. Wow. A question here, no name, and it's saying, hi, Helen. At times I find my 5-year-old trying to do things that her friends do like, a particular activity in the playground. How can I give her the confidence to choose what she wants and be more of a leader rather than a follower? Good question.
And that's a great question. Questions are great today. No, just as simple as sometimes you let her try what her friends are trying, and guide her by giving her small wins when she's on her own to things that she does really well. So for example, if all her friends want to play on the swings and she's not at her best, let her try it. Even if she doesn't do well, that's fine. But then when she's on her own, suggest things, because she's very young. You can suggest things, and as soon as she does them, give her a quick win. Give her positive feedback that is quick and related to the task at hand. I love how you've done that puzzle. I love how you read the story to your sister. I love how you helped clean up your table, your plate after you're done. Quick feedback that's consistent, especially when you want a habit to form.
Mm-hmm.
And when she does that constantly, her daughter will start looking into other directions. If she tells her, don't follow your friends and don't copy them, it's just wasting your breath.
Okay, so it's about showing and consistency rather than instruction,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Exactly.
Troy's been in touch saying, about child development, a close friend has a 6-year-old girl that expresses herself through crying or other drama for the simplest issues. We try and reinforce in a positive way that she can accomplish the same thing by acting in normal or polite manner. We haven't been very successful. Troy, this could be my daughter. I think this is, and this is so true of so many parents I'm speaking to right now. It seems like frequent tantrums, frequent tears, a lot of kids just feeling a little bit out of sorts, and we need to be the port in the storm. So my kind of mission for this week, Nan, thank you to you, is trying to remain calm. I'm going to send this podcast to my husband to encourage the children to not race to the bedroom, just so we can go to bed a little bit earlier. And thank you again for your advice. And thank you to everyone who's been in touch. As Nan said, some brilliant questions. If anyone's been listening at home or in the car and thinks, actually, I could really do some, you know, kind of one-on-one specific advice to our situation, what's the best way of getting in touch with you, Hanan?
On Instagram, my handle is @thefamilyhug_Hanan, H-A-N-A-N.
Honestly, if it wasn't for COVID, I would be moving you into my home. Like a super nanny situation, because you are amazing. Hanan, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate your time. Take care.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We have discussed COVID brain fog on the show before. It is a thing. I am absolute testament to this. My concentration levels are beyond appalling. And this week is Brain Awareness Week. Hopefully in the next half hour, we'll be learning some techniques to improve our brain power. Also finding out how students have been impacted academically thanks to concentration issues brought on by the pandemic. Joined now by Sam Arish, the owner and director at Brain and Learning. Now, Samra, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. Brain Awareness Week. Tell us more.
Good afternoon, Helen.
Good afternoon.
How are you? And thank you so much for having me on the show. Yes, March 15th to the 21st marks this year's Brain Awareness Week. And Brain Awareness Week is actually just a global campaign to increase public awareness of the benefits, progress in the brain research. So partner organizations such as ourselves help celebrate Brain Awareness Week, and it's supported by the Dana Foundation.
I'm sure everyone listening can name at least one issue that they've contended with our brains during the pandemic, and that might be brain fog, headaches, crazy dreams, concentration issues. What kind of things are you hearing from some of the clients?
And these are all the kind of things I'm hearing from my clients. So inability to focus, fatigue, lack of sleep or excessive sleep, inability to process information that they would do in everyday life, forgetfulness. So these are all the things that we are hearing from kids to adults. So it's happening to everybody.
And you've said that students have been affected in all sorts of different ways. We know we've discussed about mental health impact on kids, social impact. We're going to be talking about children and toddlers doing courses and classes later on in the show today, and academically as well. What kind of issues do you feel like we can address through kind of brain training in some ways with students and young people?
Helen, one of the main issues that students are facing is the inability to focus and concentrate. Mm-hmm. And pandemic being one of the main reasons, and not directly related, but indirectly related. So the fact that kids are spending excessive amount of time on screens is impacting their attention and their sleep cycles. The ability to process information is getting affected by that. The lack of sleep or their insufficient social interaction is also impacting these skills. So brain training actually helps sharpen these skills. So a child's ability to focus or pay attention or sustain attention is strengthened by brain training, or the ability to retrieve past information. All the skills that are required for learning are actually enhanced because of brain training. That's what we do in simple terms.
So what can we do at home? What are some of the things that we as adults can be doing? But, you know, as we are talking children's health this afternoon, what are some of the exercises we perhaps could be doing with children to improve their focus, improve their ability to concentrate for longer periods of time and to absorb the huge amounts of information that's being thrown at them, whether that's in class or in distance learning?
I think one of the simplest ways we can do that is establishing routines, consistent routines, because kids thrive on consistency, and that is the key to success. So if they're consistent in their eating habits, their study routines, and their sleep, you will see the child's ability to focus better the next day. So that's one of the main things that I stress on parents to do is consistency. Reduce screen times. That would be another one. So not only for themselves, for the kids, but for ourselves as well. A lot of times parents don't realize that we are using screens as much as our kids. We may be in a very deep conversation with our child, and as soon as a WhatsApp message pops up or an email, we would directly go on the phone and try to reply back. That impacts their ability to interact and to be able to divide their attention, because we are not modeling idle behavior. So I would say reduce screen time for kids and for adults as well.
So are you ready to flex your own knowledge on the brain, Samra?
Yes.
Okay, right. I'm very curious on some of these. Brain size does determine intelligence, true or false?
So what do you think, Helen?
I think
does that, it or does it not?
I think it does not.
And that's right. It does not. That's the truth. It does not determine intelligence.
And the brain is the fattiest organ in the body, truth or myth?
Truth. It is the fattiest organ in the body. It's 60% fat.
Really? Okay. What about this one? And I think about this a lot. You only use 10% of your brain. Is that true?
And what do you think? What do you think? Because this is a very popular one, actually.
Well, I have no idea. I think some of these facts you pick up, or so-called facts, and you just kind of internalize them and think that they are true. I mean, I do wonder what else is going on the 90%. I could be an absolute superstar if I tapped into you another 5%. So, true?
It's a myth.
It's a myth,
it's a
is
myth.
It? Okay.
It's a myth.
What
yeah.
kind of percentage do you think we're actually working with?
Some American studies have shown that we are actually using 65% of our brains.
Okay. Right. Now, you are either left or right brain dominant, which determines whether you're creative or more logical. What's the truth behind that, Samra?
Actually, it's very popular. A lot of people think that because you're right-sided and you use the right side of the brain more, you're more creative. It's actually a myth. There is no such thing as being left and right-sided brain. We use both sides of the hemispheres equally. So it's always working in tandem. So it's a myth.
What about this one? Some people can taste shapes and colors.
That's truth.
Tell us more.
Okay, so the science behind it is that a lot of times, the phenomena is actually called synesthesia. It comes from a Greek word which means to perceive together. So people have the ability to hear, smell, and taste, and feel pain and color. That's really odd, but that's how it happens. Others might just taste shapes and experience colors or tactile sensations when in the presence of music. So you can feel a certain sensation when you're listening to a certain type of music. That happens.
I think I have a little bit of this. I have... This is one. I'm a bit nervous about saying this. I have certain numbers, letters, words, even days of the week and months of the year have a shape and structure around me when I see them. They have colours attached to them. And we all grow up thinking that red is red. And in my mind, October is navy blue. And I've got no idea why that is or where it came from. So to my mind, it's normal. And I had quite an odd conversation with a friend a few years ago. And I'm like, well, yes, you know, the months, you know, come up around me and they get higher and then they go behind me, and October's this color and March is red. And she looked at me as if I was from another planet. Should
Helen,
I be worried?
Not at all. Because I had another student the other day. She was 15, 16 years old. And she said, my math numbers are revolving around colors. So she perceives numbers as colors. And that's how she's become so good at math. And I'm just looking at her because this was something I've read before. And now you're a testament. I had another. So this actually happened.
Okay.
You associate. Yeah. So it's a truth, actually. Some people can taste shapes and colors associated with certain words.
Interesting. No taste for me, just colours and almost my movement around me. If anyone else has this, please let me know on 4001. Interesting that that's two people you've encountered recently that have had this. And Samra,
exactly.
Are you able to explain a little bit about what happens at the brain and learning and how people can reach out, get some assistance and boost their brain power too?
All right. So in simple terms, the program is actually based on the science of neuroplasticity that tells us that the brain is flexible and can respond to environmental challenges. So, for example, I feel my memory is not good, something that we all experience day in, day out. And it's always coming from cognitive skills. These are the skills that we're using every single day to perform mental actions or tasks or retrieving information. So what we do is we target these skills and make them go through certain experiences for them to be able to create neural pathways and increase brain performance and function.
So what's the best way of getting in touch with you? And can it be a one-off thing, or is it a case of signing up for a course, so to speak?
Yes, so it's actually case dependent. It really depends, because our youngest student is 4 and our oldest has been 72. So it's for everybody. So the best thing to do is to do an assessment for us to find out what kind of training program you're going to be on, because each individual is born with a unique cognitive profile. Something that may be easy for you may be very difficult. Based on our weaknesses, that's when you develop the program, and it's varying for everybody.
So interesting. And just a quick update, nobody's messaged in saying that they also think that, well, the number 8 is dark green. So maybe I am alone in this. Samra, thank you so much. Have a wonderful Brain Awareness Week ahead. Samra there from The Brain and Learning.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We talk family life, but education, parenting, children's health, and turning our attentions now to those older children. It's spring, traditionally a time when revision timetables are made, study nights are locked in, and tensions often rise in the homes where teens have got exams looming. However, this year is set to be rather different for lots of students, with cancellations. So get in touch to share how you or your teen feels about this. To discuss further, we've got Jamie Cacaldi. He is from Oxford AQA to explain a little bit more about what's been happening internationally, but also here in the region as well. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us. Are you in the UK now?
I am indeed, yes. I'm here at home in the UK. Last time I spoke to you, I was actually in the studio with you.
I know, it's so strange, isn't it?
Yeah, back in the day when international travel was an option.
Back in the day, we'd have people
nice
in the studio.
Yeah,
it's all on the phone now. Well, thank you for taking time out of your Sunday and the papers and Sunday dinners and walks in the wood and all of that good stuff that happens on a Sunday in the UK. Let's set the scene, though. Let's go back a step. Can you explain a little bit about why exams have been cancelled, even when students in the UK and internationally are now back in schools?
Absolutely. So the key thing here in all of these decisions is fairness, and it's fairness for the students in particular. If we think about this as a global issue, the pandemic obviously is a global issue, therefore it requires a global response. We have a situation where it's really impossible to predict where exams can and can't be held if you look at it on an international scale. So therefore, if we ran exams, we'd be in a situation where students in different parts of the world are being judged in different ways. And this is particularly true as soon as the exam series was cancelled in the UK. We have a situation where students in the UK are being judged in one way, and international students are being judged in a different way, and potentially being disadvantaged through that. And I think we can't have a situation where groups of students are disadvantaged in comparison to others. And particularly as an international exam board, it really just wouldn't be fair for international students to be assessed in a different way to their UK counterparts.
So rather than going on a kind of country by country basis, it's really trying to level the playing field as far as possible, especially, as you say, when international students could well be coming into the UK with students who have been educated there.
Absolutely, yes. If you're applying to a UK university, say, if you're doing international A-levels, or even applying to GCSEs to go to a school in the UK, or then and subsequently to a UK university, it'd be completely unfair if your grades were assessed in a different way to a UK student. I think also, if you have a situation where some schools are taking exams, or some parts of the world are taking exams, you create essentially a mixed economy in terms of the grades that are assigned. And that inevitably leads to some students being disadvantaged. So if you think about, if you're trying to compare grades delivered by through exams and grades given through the sort of school assessment process, you have to have some kind of system for aligning those two systems. And then you end up in a situation a bit like last year with the algorithm, where grades are being adjusted to make sure they fit a particular profile. And I think nobody wants that.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask then, what happens next for anyone who hasn't been informed or is curious about the alternative to examinations that might have been faced in previous years? How are these students going to be assessed come the end of term?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really important to stress that students are only being assessed on what they have been taught. You know, the students across the world have faced incredible disruption this year. And our key aim is to make sure that no student is disadvantaged. So with that in mind, there's an extent to which teachers are going to be doing what they have always done, which is teaching students the course content, you know, along with the knowledge and the skills they need to be successful in that qualification. What will happen now is we, as an example, will supply some assessment materials to schools. So these will be based on past paper questions. So that, you know, there'll be an accurate reflection of the kind of assessment that students will have taken in a real exam. But crucially, they won't be mandatory. These are not exams. They're not even mock exams. They are assessment materials that, that teachers can use in a way that they see fit, in a way that will best help their students display the knowledge and skills that they have. So these will be broken down into topic areas within the curriculum. So again, students, teachers rather can use the materials that are appropriate for the subject content that their students have covered. But this is only one part of an evidence pack. So students will be assessed holistically. So if students have sat mock exams, for example, if students have produced any coursework over the course of their qualification, if they've done practice questions in class, all of these things can feed into an holistic teacher judgment on the grade that that student has worked at and is working at across the course that they've covered. So it's really important to see this as an holistic, empowered teacher judgment.
I think what kind of raises concerns for me is when when I think about back to my A-levels, there were some teachers that I got on really well with and some teachers that I didn't particularly care for and I knew they didn't care for me. Whereas with an exam, there's, you know, anonymity there. There's, you know, it seems to be very much a level playing field. These exams are submitted and assessed, whereas it feels so much more personal when it's a teacher looking at that. There could be an average student who's a bit of a suck up, for want of a better phrase, who might have a great personal relationship with the teacher. How can you mitigate that?
So there'll be extensive training on in terms of the grading process. So when the exam series was cancelled, we sent out a survey to all our schools asking them what support they felt they needed in order to award grades accurately and fairly. And, you know, as an ex-teacher myself and as someone with, you know, kids in school.
Jamie, you didn't like all your students, be honest.
More importantly, I'm not sure all my teachers liked me when I was a kid. I think more to the point. You know, I know, you know, how important it is that and how dedicated teachers are to making sure there is a level playing field. And that, you know, the feedback from that survey was very much along the lines of, how do we make sure there is complete consistency? How do we make sure that our grading is consistent? And not just our grading internally, but the grading globally. You know, if we think about all the schools doing this. So it's going to be extensive training, not just in terms of marking work. You know, there will be guidance on how to mark assessments, how to mark accurately. And we'll use, you know, exemplars of student answers and show how the mark scheme has been applied. And all that, that support will be there. But in addition to that, the feedback we got from the survey said that it's actually turning the marks into grades that where teachers want the most support. So there'll be grade descriptors for every subject and every qualification that we offer. And along with that, there'll be training on how you arrive at a grade, which includes things like unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about a situation where, you know, teachers who have students who have a better personal relationship with a teacher. We know that those unconscious biases can, you know, sort of form a part of making a judgment. So there'll be training on how you can avoid that at a personal level, also how you can avoid that at a departmental and school level. So that, you know, you can talk about in-school standardisation, double-checking of teachers' assessments across departments and across within schools. So there's a lot of work and a lot of thought that's gone into how we can make sure this is absolutely consistent and absolutely fair for all students in all centres all across the world.
I did want to ask you about workload for teachers. And can I just say absolute kudos to all of the teachers, the heads, the principals, educators out there for dealing with the last year? Because it has been a year now of chaos and disruption and change, you know, having to adapt to so many different rules and methods of teaching. And you've all done an amazing job. And now, yes, the exams, of course, is another variable. What impact will this assessment process have on teachers' workload, Jamie? Can you clarify that for us?
Certainly. And first of all, I would absolutely echo your sentiments about what an incredible job teachers and schools globally have done throughout this year. It's been genuinely awe-inspiring and quite humbling, actually. You know, and as I said, you know, as a former teacher myself, I'm still in touch with a lot of my friends from schools, mainly here in the UK, although some international teachers as well now. And, you know, I'm aware of the impact it's had and the workload they've had to do to put in an entirely new educational system, really, almost overnight. So absolutely huge, huge thanks to them from everybody. In terms of the workload around the move to school-assessed grades and away from traditional SAT exams, we are doing, you know, everything we can to make sure schools feel supported. And crucially, we're making sure that what we're asking of schools isn't an extra burden, an extra layer of work on what is already a very busy job, of course. So, you know, I mentioned those assessment materials we're going to be supplying to schools. Again, to reiterate, those are not mandatory. They are not, you know, a replacement set of exams that schools are now responsible or teachers are now responsible for delivering. Those are there as a support package, as a support resource for teachers to, you know, fine tune and calibrate their grading process. So they're really there to be supportive. We've also got, in every country we operate in, we have a fantastic team of support. You know, the support team we have in each country are absolutely fantastic. So over in the UAE, we have Jen and her wonderful team who will be in constant contact with all our schools. I once heard a head teacher describe Jen and her team as providing Emirates business class level service. And I don't think you can get a much of a higher compliment
than
that.
Take that compliment.
So,
love it.
Exactly. I mean, quite extraordinary. So, yeah, I mean, they do a fantastic job to support their schools. They make sure their schools are fully informed of what they need to do, of how they're going to be supported, the training and the resources that we're going to supply. But really, it's about teachers being empowered to make a confident decision, empowered with the confidence that other schools are going to be applying the same protocols in the same way, and there's going to be a fair and consistent process for all students. Yeah, and as part of that, you know, our role as an exam board is to make sure that the grades that are issued are valid and are comparable. So, you know, we'll be in constant communication here from the UK as well to all our schools around the world, making sure that they're aware of the process and what they need to do. And particularly schools, you know, if they're new to delivering Oxford A2A specs, will be there to make sure they feel, you know, really supported in those initial stages.
Going to the text line, and unsurprisingly, lots of parents reaching out on this topic. One
of
saying, I do support the cancellation of exams. I think the pandemic has given us an opportunity to progressively move forward from assessing kids based on one single exam sitting to a more holistic approach of assessing a child and teachers the one that knows that student best. Do you think this could change the face of examinations forever, Jamie?
It's very possible. I mean, you know, it's been such a kind of paradigm shift, if you'll excuse a sort of a marketing cliche, but sort of, yeah, there's been such a change in the perception of exams and examination and schooling and education in the last year. You know, if you'd said, you know, 18 months ago that children will be going to school anywhere in the world for several months, people would have thought you were absolutely mad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, schools have adapted and kids have adapted. And, you know, as much as we're saying the teachers have been amazing, and they have, so have the students. I mean, they've had
absolutely
an incredible disruption.
And the parents, by the way.
We're all being amazing.
Thank
you for that. So I think, you know, there are absolutely, you know, questions to be asked about, you know, the process around assessing students going forward. You know, I think exams will always be a part of that. I think, you know, we believe in exams for all the reasons that you mentioned earlier. But I think, you know, the idea of looking at assessment again through this prism is absolutely an appropriate thing to do. So I'm part here back in the UK, along with colleagues in Oxford AQA and AQA, the UK exam board that we're affiliated with, looking at the future of assessment, what that's going to look like in 5 years' time and in 10 years' time. You know, looking at potentially online or digital assessment, if we think those are valid ways of doing things, more continuous teacher assessment. Of course, these are all questions that we should be asking. And I think it's also only fair to point out that, you know, these questions aren't necessarily in themselves new. And these are questions that we were asking
Absolutely.
Before the pandemic. So
could just be a catalyst.
Always questions.
Jamie, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. I'm going to let you get back to your, hopefully a lazy Sunday afternoon before you get back to the office at Oxford AQA tomorrow, or maybe working from home, most likely. Jamie, thank you so, so much. And this is a conversation we will be continuing over the course of the next few months as assessments do continue.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We talk children's health, education and parenting. And as we know, music can play a really important role in our children's growth, even before birth. And exposing your child to music can ignite all sorts of areas of child development. Doing this early can ensure your baby grows up healthy. We're sitting down with Riette from Bloom Baby to find out how music helps to develop a young child's brain and asking what songs we should be listening to. Riette, thank you so much for joining us. You have a bit of a dream job in some ways. I can't think of anything better than sitting on the floor with lovely little ones, having, you know, a few tambourines. And apart from if you've got a headache, I'm sure, tell us a little bit about Bloom Baby first.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. Yes, it is great working with the babies. You can see how they develop and learn, and almost weekly you can just see how they, 1 week they don't get exactly what you want them to do, and the next week they just know exactly what they need to do. Bloom Classes is a sensory development class, and we use music throughout our class to develop our babies, to help them grow and just teach them about life.
So, as I said, there's, I think most people do enjoy music, and inevitably there's music growing up in the home or in the car. But when we think about bringing a baby into the world, there can be ways that we can incorporate music into their upbringing and even their development. Before they're even born, though, what effect does music have on babies in the womb?
When you play music to your baby, they get used to the sounds up while they're in your womb. And research has shown that if you play a song over and over to your baby, when they're born, that music calms them down. Mm-hmm. So they listen to outside music and outside sounds. So it's always great to play music to your baby even before they're born, that you can use that specific music later on to calm them down and help them develop.
And is there any particular, you know, should it be a bit of Bob Marley to chill them out? Does it really matter what the genre is?
No, it doesn't matter. It's what makes mommy and daddy happy, and you just expose your child to the music that you enjoy. And it's also how you interact with your child while playing the music that helps them develop.
I remember driving when I was pregnant with my firstborn, and Pitbull Fireball came on the radio, and she started kicking like crazy. And I sat there driving going, if you like Pitbull, there's going to be a problem here. This is not what mummy listens to.
Unfortunately, they have their own little minds when they like their music.
And now, actually, I feel like, you know, for me, the music that I love a lot of it is that, you know, the stuff we were listening to on long family car journeys, and that's the music I find myself coming back to. And I need a bit of comfort. You know, your Simon and Garfunkel, your Van Morrisons, and this isn't when I was a baby, but there's something so beautiful about listening to music as a family, that kind of nostalgia.
It just brings back all the memories.
It does. It really does. And, you know, taking it back to the classes that you do and even outside of classes, how do you think music can help develop a young child's brain? What happens, you know, what kind of, you know, neural pathways are fizzing around when music's on?
When you dance with your baby, which all mummies do, they don't even know it, when you rock your baby to sleep, when they're fussy, that motion releases the happy hormone serotonin and both your brain and your baby's brain. And that helps to calm both the parent and the baby down. It also creates the bonding hormone, that is called oxytocin, and that then helps you bond with your baby. So when you move with your baby to music, it is great because you rock them and calm them.
And I think that's exactly right. It ends up being a bit of muscle memory. I hold a baby now, I find myself kind of rocking backwards and forwards in a way that I would do for hours with my own. That's why I love baby wearing as well so much, just having them so, so close and being able to have a little kind of a little jiggle around. And when I say hours, I really do mean hours. You know, there's a lot of gadgets out there and kind of tools and sleep cues that involve music that might go in a nursery or on the side of the cot. Yes. Do you recommend using music to soothe a baby to help them get to sleep?
You can play them lullabies. Also, what you can do is, I know a lot of parents use the little stars that they hang on the side of the cot that moves around. That, if you play the right music with that, it helps your baby soothe and become calm. It also helps them develop their eyes, and eventually they will start reaching for that. So that helps them to develop their motor skills and just help them to explore and experience the world.
I might regret asking this, and parents of the UAE, I apologise, especially if you are prone to headaches, but musical instruments for toddlers, what do you think it's worth having at home? So what are some of the most popular things that kids gravitate towards in class?
What's great is that you can use day-to-day items. You don't have to go out and buy expensive toys. In class, we use the Lummy Sticks, where we teach them rhythm. And if you teach them rhythm early on in life, that helps with developing their language. So to do that back at home, you can just give them two wooden spoons or even two plastic spoons to clap together. And that helps also with gross motor skill development.
Oh, banging.
You can also make them shakers, where you put some rice in a water bottle and they can just shake away and entertain themselves for hours with the shakers.
What about socialising? I know it's a difficult time right now with COVID, and I really genuinely feel for a lot of the parents who might have given birth during this time who might have normally come to rely on mummy meetups and classes to meet people. How are you managing that with Bloom and that kind of social side, which is so important for development too?
At the moment, unfortunately, we do have to space the parents out through the class, where you stay on your mat and you get your sanitised bag with your goodies. But the mummies normally after class, they go to the coffee shop nearby and they go sit and socialise after the class, more than in the class. But you start making friends in the class that you wouldn't normally make.
Mm. And what about the kids socialising as well? Why do you feel like that's so important?
A lot of babies that were born during lockdown that didn't attend any classes. You could really see how it impacted on their social skills and their social development to the extent where they were even scared to go into the car seat. Mm. Now, after lockdown eased up, those babies are now a little bit older. They're almost one. And only now they start becoming more social, where they would try and go to another baby to interact because they didn't see any other kids during lockdown.
It's really sad, isn't it? What about online classes and things like that? Do you feel like there's a role for those?
There definitely is, but it can never replace a physical class where you take your child out and give yourself also a break and just to go and interact with other humans. Mm-hmm. It's good to see somebody on a screen, but it's screen time and you don't socialise like normal.
I'm really glad that there is still an opportunity, unlike other parts of the world, to actually be in a physical class and, as you say, have a coffee and socialise afterwards, because it's just not plausible right now for so many parts of the world.
Very hard to meet new mums, mm-hmm. especially in the UAE, because we're far away from families, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult to meet mums if you don't go out and attend classes or social activities with other mums and babies. Mm-hmm.
For anyone that's not able to come to a class or doesn't feel comfortable in that situation right now, are there any particular songs that we might be able to find on YouTube or online that you feel are really great? Well, first of all, a top baby pick would be great, a top toddler choice, and then maybe something for the ones that are a little bit older that's not, in my case, the soundtrack of Frozen 2 or Trolls World Tour.
All the Bloom music is available on Spotify or iTunes.
Amazing.
So you can just look for Bloom baby classes and the music will pop up. The most popular one for the babies is Dance with My Baby, where you can dance with your baby and lift them up high and tickle their little tummies. And it's great fun to dance with your baby. For toddlers, it's definitely the Wake Up song, where you can clap and point to different body parts. And that's how they learn through repetition. Mm-hmm. And then for the older kids, mine is driving me insane with this song, is Wind the Bobbin Up.
I love Wind the Bobbin Up.
And with that, you help them develop their gross motor skills. So each song has got some activities that you do with. If you want to see how to do the activities, you can go and look in the YouTube videos to see what you need to do and how you can interact with your child.
That was Riette of Bloom Baby Classes talking about how music can help with our baby's development.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, we are live Sunday to Thursday every single week at Dubai Eye 103.8. And on Sundays, it's all about family life, children's health, education, parenting and more. And do rate and subscribe so you get this podcast direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.